Good morning. I'm Darrell Gunter. I'm your host for Leadership on WSOU 89.5 FM. And today we're happy to have back in our studio Ms. Linda Hall, who's the author and lecturer of Anthropology and Global Studies at the University of California, Riverside, and founder of Nika Publications. I hope I said that correctly. Linda, welcome back to the program. And I thought, you know, we had such a great conversation the last time. I thought it was be so good to have you back because I didn't give you the opportunity to really dive deeper into an area. We were covering so many different things. I figured, you know what, let's have her back. Let's talk about her life experience because I think you have so much to offer to our young people, both male and female, about, you know, challenges that you face, how you dealt with them, and how you continue to deal with them for them.
Yeah, I'm excited about doing this. That's what I do for a living. You know, it's an opportunity. I could have retired and gone fishing. I love to fish. Okay. But I could have done that. But I decided to stay in California and keep up the fight. And not only that, I lost a son. That was in 25. And since then, I picked up probably 3,000 more students that other people's children who I've been fortunate enough to meet them in a time of life that they're making some huge decisions. And I work on things like critical thinking and to enrich their lives. So, yeah, let's talk about that. That's good.
So if it's okay, I like to, something you said, I didn't realize that you lost your son. Was that back in 2005?
Yes, 2005.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. If you feel comfortable to discuss, what happened?
Well, he's a good case study for a contemporary audience because he had a very difficult time. Even though I raised him the same as I raised the second son, he struggled because he was from my first marriage, which is documented in thoroughly inside the book. And it was a cluster, you know what, any other way of describing that first marriage. And I think it played havoc with his mind. And I also suspect that he might have had some mental issues. And bipolar, I strongly suspect. But in the old days, they didn't bother to diagnose. They throw a child on Ritalin, and I didn't want my child super medicated. And so he grew up prioritizing the wrong things in life, and then he got off into on a tangent where his value system didn't resemble anything like what I was raising, like, etc. And I guess his high school years were pretty chaotic. He's following in the footsteps of some people he greatly admired. And he decided that he was going to be homosexual. Now, I said decided because it was an announcement that he made when when he was about 18. And I said, I think I suspected. And okay, you know, and he was very distressed with me because I wasn't upset about his homosexuality. But to me, that was his life choice. And I was going to love him and support him no matter what, but that wasn't what he wanted. I don't know to this day what exactly in the way, you know, what acknowledgement he wanted, but I obviously didn't give the right one. And so he went through a stage that he went to college for a year and about a half at Fort Valley, I think, in Georgia. Is that a college? And after that, he ended up in Atlanta, and he ended up stripping and doing all kinds of things. And I didn't know much about his lifestyle, but he contracted AIDS. And I'm running like years ahead here because we're talking a person that now is 30. Okay. And so after his 30th birthday, he was so sick that the family had to rescue him and went to Atlanta, took him back to Tennessee. He lasted several months under my husband's care, because I was in California by then. And my
Mm-hmm.
husband, I still have a house in Tennessee, and a husband, and he was watching over him. But we didn't realize, and doctors don't share the information about their patients, of course, a grown person. We didn't know how sick he really was, but he was what's called a multiple infected case. Hepatitis, I think he had that in addition to the AIDS, and then his kidneys failed. And we knew nothing except that suddenly he was on dialysis, and he would not accept his illness at all. He insisted on trying to go to work, doing everything like he normally did it. We could not slow him down. I lost touch because I'm separated from my husband, and it was like them back there and me here in California. The next thing I know, my youngest son calls me one morning when I'm living in Santa Barbara and tells me he's dead. That was
I'm
it.
sorry to hear that. Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, he eventually just went to sleep and died. So he had a very peaceful departure, and but for the family, it was traumatic because we had no chance to save him. You know, if I had to caution someone, I think all of us at some point in our lives contemplate suicide. I have to admit it, I've done it. I think most of my friends that I know have done the same thing. They've had something really horrible happen. But the one thing that hopefully will stop you is if you can just breathe and think about what you're leaving behind and how the people will suffer, you know, because I mean, we can't still to this day, because my husband found him in bed deceased and he's traumatized. He won't even talk about it. My youngest son won't discuss him without crying. And this is a grown man now crying. And you know, no, and he left us all like this, just broken as far as he's concerned. So if you just consider if the thought passes through your mind and you don't think you have anybody, there are national suicide hotlines, of course, that you call. And there are always people that care about you. You just don't know it. And you know, when you're that backed up by depression, you think nobody cares. But there's always somebody that's gonna be left behind that's gonna be broken by what your departure. And it just really isn't fair. I mean, not just broken for the moment, not just broken for the funeral, broken for friggin' ever.
How
Okay,
have
they can never get over it.
how do you address it? How do you deal with it?
Most of the time, I still don't think about it. I'll be honest, because if I dwell on it, it's like that task as a mother I was supposed to do, and I failed. You understand? And you know my history now from the book and our conversations. And I'm a person who's always strive to succeed, and to have that happen on my watch. You know, even though it really wasn't my watch, he was nowhere near me when it happened. But I felt like there's, you know, if I think about it too much, it's always I could have done what I should have, would have, could have. And I don't like being in that position. But look, we all have bad things happen to us. And you just have to keep going. And that's the, you know, the kind of stuff that happened to me during my life. And I'm no different than probably anybody in your audience. The kinds of stuff that makes you want to quit. But I was always able to get up and keep pushing until COVID stopped me. COVID stopped me. And it debilitated me to an extent that I'm still not over it. And I'm not the same person as I was before. And it's like a death almost of the person I used to be. So I think that the only good outcome was the fact that the book was written. I had the time to sit down and finish the book. I had dropped the book in 2005. Now you know why I dropped it, because of his death. And I could not pick the book back up and start writing again until 2020. It lasted that long. I was so traumatized. I wrote other things, but I couldn't get back to memoir. You know, I couldn't go there because I was at the stage where he was born. Okay, and then I had to tell the whole story, and I knew that, and I just couldn't face it. But I did, and I wrote about it, and it helped, but it still hurts. I mean, you know, I'm human, you know.
What would you say when you look at your memoir? What are the three most important lessons that you learn and that you want your audience to come away with that maybe they'll benefit from?
It all goes back to things that, and I was prepping for this, and you're gonna laugh. You know how you get your book all ready to talk about it, you know. And I don't wanna, I'm gonna veer off from the script that I kind of planned, but and I'm gonna go to like, you know, maybe halfway down where I would have been talking. And mostly I went back to try to analyze what were the key messages from my past. And especially for my mother, that have repeatedly saved me. And what were the things that defined all of the crises that I was confronted with? And the two things were truth and hate. I was always struggling to find the truth, and I was always trying to avoid the hatred. I would do anything to stop from hating people. I mean, when it got to that point, I would just walk. You know, even if it cost for walking 2,000 miles, okay, to come to California, you know, I would not exercise hate because I knew that I shouldn't do it. My mother counseled me that I shouldn't do it. I had examples of when people had actually done things motivated by hate that I said, you know, I'm not going to take that path. And then, of course, wrestling with the truth. And the telling of truth and the commitment to always try to be a truthful person. And I think we all have to fight that battle first to identify what it is, you know, because it's always positioned, it's juxtapositioned, you know, against telling truth versus telling a lie. But sometimes those shady areas, you know, like when you're running a business, I talk about that in the book. You find yourself pushed up against deadlines and you end up telling lies, and you know, there you go, bam, you know, over the line. And so little things like that happened to me in my life, but all it seems like everything that really shaped who I am was concerned with battles that I was struggling with about truth and truisms, and then of course trying to avoid slipping off into hatred. So that's really two of the things. And besides that, I would say the third is that juxtapositioning. It's something that, you know, having not wanting to see the world like that. I do everything to avoid not seeing the gray areas. Too many people, and we have a society right now that is positioning itself so that it only sees what's on the left or the right. We don't want to discuss anything that's on the sides. We don't want to compromise. It's my way or the highway, zero sum. You know, hey, I'm right. You know, why are you in my face? Okay. And I don't want to be that type of thing. So that is the third thing that I struggle with, is that I want to always be able to identify when I'm confronted with something like that. And if somebody's trying to force me to see things either one way or the other, I always want to say, wait, no, this is not right. That usually is a really bad sign. If somebody's making you make a decision, you know what I'm saying? You know, hey, this is my way or the highway. And you're going like, highway? You know, that drastic? I have, yes, my way or the highway. Okay. But I don't have anything to do with that. That's a warning sign for me. That's a person I want to avoid. And I will, you know, it probably high cost sometime to me too. I've walked away from situations that cost me money because of it, but that's okay. I feel good.
That's the exact point I was going to raise there, is that while you might have walked away from some money, but who you are as a person, you didn't want to walk away from that.
No. You always have to stay true to yourself. But then again, that becomes a struggle because as we grow, we change. And if you have old ghosts and old things following you because of, and I had a conversation recently about this with somebody else. If you have these old ghosts from your past that are trying to cling to you. And I went through a stage in my life in my 20s when I was like that, when I couldn't shed those old ghosts, and they make you, they distort you. It's like they're pulling you, you know,
Let's
so you can't sustain.
let's talk about that for a second. Can you describe the ghost, the old
Okay, it's
ghost?
Okay, well, this is another chapter that's in the book where I talk about the family in Oklahoma, in Tulsa, the Jemersons, that were kind to God. Always were there for me. And when I started going to college, first of all, I went from Pittsburgh, from high school in 1966, to directly to Dallas, Texas, to Bishop College. At Bishop College, that's where I met the Jemerson family. And the Jemerson family took me the first Christmas, as they knew I had nowhere to go back in Pittsburgh. By that time, I was completely separated from my family. They took me back to Tulsa with them. And the mother of the family, for some reason, just embraced me and decided that I was like a daughter to her. And so summers I would go to Tulsa, but those old ghosts from Pittsburgh were on my back. The bad experience that I'd had in what's called Truman Avenue Home for Girls, because I left the confines of the home that raised me when I was 15, because I could no longer get along with the person who was raising me. And I decided to go in to be institutionalized. And I went into the system, and the system, I was in there and exposed to women, young women who were hookers, young women who were taking drugs. I had never seen anything like this in my life. And if I'd have known that was the type of environment that I would be exposed to, I don't think that I would have done it. But I'm glad now that I did, because I got my first immersion into what Black life was really like in the inner city. You see, I lived in the suburbs of Pittsburgh. I didn't grow, and I went to, you know, all white schools, and I went, you know, until I was 15. And so, only time it was kind of funny. If you know Pennsylvania, or any major metropolitan area, you know that what the suburbs are completely, the burb doesn't resemble the inner city. And so, I had no idea, except on weekends, every once in a while, when I go get my hair done, you know, I got to know what the inner city was like. And all of that was going on up there, I didn't see it, because I'm looking through the eyes of a child. All I saw was, you know, people drinking a lot and a lot of hollering and crapping. It didn't make any sense to me. And of course, my mother never introduced me to anybody like that. She always shielded me. But I thrust myself into that, and I was like being beat up, thrown down steps. I mean, but you know, it made me realize that what I left behind, I had to make a decision. Was that the right thing for me? Because at that time, my mother was taking medication that had caused her to be violent at times, and she would beat me. And so I said, well, if I go back to Bellevue, which is the suburb name in Pittsburgh, you know, I'm going to be beaten, I'm going to be abused there. What's the difference? I only have 2 more years of high school. If I can suffer through this, I can get out of it. But I didn't realize I was bringing all those ghosts with me. And so the people in Tulsa, they tolerated me, and they really loved me despite myself. I mean, I would lock myself, not lock, but I would go into the room that they gave me, and I wouldn't, you know, socialize like I should, and I would do all kinds of stuff. And I thought I was being normal, but I really wasn't, because this is an ideal family. You know, mother, father. I mean, they weren't Leave It to Beaver, but they were as close to it for a Black family as you possibly could be. I mean, they had very stable jobs, a nice house, and they treated me like a family. And that was the first family I'd had in a decade, really. And so I went to Knoxville College. I left Bishop in college, and I went to Knoxville College, because I had a better offer. And when I got to Knoxville College, a taxi driver, and this is the era in which there was a lot of shooting and protests in the streets in the 60s. This is 1968, okay, when things are really, really hostile. White cab driver drove onto campus for some reason. He was killed. and the whole campus just it was a total disruption of everything. And I got on a bus. That's what we used to do in the old days. Okay. Got on a bus, a Trailways bus, and I took that to Dallas. And she, being the mother of the family, left everything behind in Tulsa. She came from Tulsa to Dallas, and she told me, she said, "You don't run from situations. You've got to stop running. You can't do this. You know, people love you. You've got to go back and you've got to succeed." You know, and so she talked to me for 2 days. She came down, I mean, just like it was a daughter, and just came down and sat with me. She gave me bus fare to go back to Knoxville, and then my life proceeded. That woman is, and the reason I brought her up is I want to pay tribute to Doris Jemerson. Doris Jemerson saved my life. She really did. Now, things didn't go as they were planned when I came back to Knoxville, but that's another story. But when it comes to a lesson of love, this is the woman who taught me that no matter what you see in front of you, it's not what you think it is. Okay? She loved me despite myself. She came to every one of my graduations. When I finally buckled down, I was 60 some years old. She came, now she's an 80-year-old woman, flew here to California for my bachelor's degree. She flew through my first master's. She was there. She came here for my second master's, and she was with me when I got my PhD.
Beautiful.
If that's not a mother, then what is? And now she's sitting in a rocking chair in Tulsa and 90 some years old and spunky and my hero. Okay. So
Wow.
yeah. And she taught me also resilience. And independence as a Black woman, very independent Black woman. I learned a lot from that lady, and I learned by observation. You know, she didn't raise me like she did all her daughters are very successful now. One's an attorney, one's a former school administrator. But I was like the black sheep because I dropped out. Okay. And I didn't get back in the system. She never quit on me. She always said, "Oh, you're going to do something one day. You're going to, one of these days, I know you're going to be something." And I went, "Okay. All right." And I had no idea. She knew, though. I guess moms know, don't they?
She believed. She believed. You know, this story, I would love to hear you tell this story over and over and over again to young people. You know,
Yeah.
because they need to know that yes, your life is not perfect, but you can make it better. You can make it better. And strive and do well. You know, recently, some years ago, what was it, 2017? I'm trying to think of the name of the shelter for the kids that they have. And I interviewed the director of Covenant House.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
After I interviewed him for this radio show, I went home and I cried because to hear the stories of the kids that come through Covenant House, and then at some point they have to release them. And the system doesn't provide, you know, a bridge for them. You know, so he says most of the times after they leave here, they die, you know.
Oh, God.
Yeah. But for, you know, for them to hear your story and have that champion that you had is just really
One
just
thing that was, and in case you might imagine, well, everything was perfect, you know, but even when I was in Terman Avenue Home, the institution, the one thing that kept happening was the struggle did not between truth and falsehood did not stop. Someone gave me advice, a counselor, a white middle-aged woman, okay, that gave me advice, and it could have changed my life, and it ended up changing my life, but not in the way she expected it to. She told me, "Here I'm sitting with a good ACT score and an offer from Pitt, you know, if I wanted to go. Physics now, I had talked to somebody in the department. If I wanted to pursue it, they were going to try to help me to get in. Okay, I go into the counselor's office in high school, and I tell her, you know, well, I need to make a decision about where to go to school. And so she says, and I mentioned, I said, I like Penn State and I kind of like University of Pittsburgh. Oh, you're not ready to go there yet. And I said, excuse me. You know, she said, no, you're not prepared yet. You need to start. And she pulled this flyer out, and inside the flyer was about UC, what is it they used to call HBCUs? They add UC something around. Anyway, it was the HBCUs. She pulled that out and she said, these are the types of schools that you need to attend. And I said, why are you saying that? She said, because I've looked at your record and, you know, I really feel this is the best fit for you. Well, I listened to her and I made a mistake. Okay. Because I was absolutely the worst fit for an HBCU. That, I mean, I had no Black identity at all. Okay. I didn't know anything about being a Black woman. I was just this generic person from Pittsburgh who had happened to go to school with a lot of people who were Polish, German, Italian. And to me, ethnicity meant that I was a group of a sub from the suburbs. I was a suburban person, an entity. I had no idea what was expected of me. The social values, the whole culture was foreign. It was like you could have sent me to Russian, and I would have had the same outcome. I failed miserably. Now you're looking at a woman who graduated from honors in every level in the UC system. Okay. I could not master anything above a C in HBCU. I was so distressed, but I didn't know who I was. And then, you know, toting around those ghosts too, and all, you know, and feeling like I didn't fit in, you know. And then I was so estranged. And so that was a time in my life that the Doris Jemerson happened. And she gave me at least enough of a belief in myself that I stopped internalizing all of that madness. And that's the point that I changed. When I stopped letting it get in here, you know, it started to ease up and allow me to live. I don't carry those ghosts anymore. I don't blame anybody for everything I did now, Daryl. I did it. Okay. Good or bad.
Well, this has been a very, very delightful conversation. As you know, I wish I had more time, but we only have 29 minutes, and we're coming down to the last minute. Any last words of wisdom you want to leave with
Uh-oh, wait a
our
minute.
guests?
You got me dipping in here for my stuff. Okay.
Okay.
My favorite leader, Fannie Lou Hamer. Yes. Why? And we can close with this. Okay. Now, this is good. Hamer, correct? I think that's how she pronounced her name. My best friend said, don't mess it up. Hamer, the great survivor of tragedy and conqueror of personal difficulties. Little is ever mentioned about the meaning of her defeats for her own life. It seems only fair and profitable to try to talk about her pain too, but not in a way in which we emphasize only her survival of that pain and those challenges. And finally, in the lives of historic African American women, there is also pain, pain that they learn to accommodate in their lives, yet never quite quit defeating or overtaking it. More than anything, Hamer taught others how to coexist with pain and challenge. My
Wow.
hero.
Beautiful, beautiful. And also, did you happen to connect with Dr. Forrest Pritchett at Seton Hall University?
I haven't heard from him since the initial contact, but I
Okay.
imagine he's busy. It's
He's
end of term, right?
no, we're right in the middle. We're right in the middle right now.
Oh,
We're
okay.
right in the middle right now. So I just want to make sure that, because you're all really, really great, great people. He was my professor. When I was a at Seton Hall University, and
Oh.
my senior year, I made a mistake, and he helped me to correct it. And I tell you, I learned from it. So, but
good. I can't wait to meet him. I'm excited.
Okay. Excellent. Ladies and gentlemen, we are here with Dr. Linda Hall, who is the author and lecturer, Anthropology, Global Studies at the University of California, Riverside, and the founder of Anika Publications. She has two really, really great books. One is Gifting Resilience, a Pandemic Study of the Black Female Resistance. And your other book was what, Three Rivers?
Three Rivers Crossed.
That's right. That's right. And we want to thank you for coming on the program again. You know, thank it's you. Really good. And we look forward to having our next conversation in the near future.
Oh, thank you very much.
That wraps it up this week, ladies and gentlemen, on Leadership with Darrell W. Gunter. And we want you to have a great weekend. But remember, leadership begins with you.